This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Feminasty, the complicated woman's guide to surviving the patriarchy without drinking herself to death. Written and read by Erin Gibson. To women, you are not my competition. Introduction. During the Great Depression, Lysol was the number one form of contraception for women. You heard that correctly. Lysol, the number one product for cleaning up elementary school puke, was marketed back then as a feminine hygiene douche for women. Feminine hygiene in the early 30s wasn't about keeping your flapper hoo-ha fresh and minty. It was woman code for birth control, which was illegal. So Lysol stepped in and became a woman's first and only resort to prevent pregnancy. While the days of disinfectant douches are behind us, because we're too young to have experienced it, or because it melted our insides and we died, women still have about 400 million obstacles to overcome. Some we know about. Unequal pay, underrepresentation in government, reproductive restrictions, lack of floor-length mirrors in hotel rooms. But a lot of them are harder to identify. They're the white noise of oppression that we've accepted as lady business as usual. And the patriarchy wants to keep it that way. Too bad I don't give a fuck about what the patriarchy wants. I'm here to make sure we're smarter than the patriarchy. That we identify every single way they're trying to fuck with our lives. That we see through their lies and deceit and power-hungry motivations and find ways to subvert and destroy their system. Except for In-N-Out, they can stay. It's time to go ham on the patriarchy, and I'm just the bitch to show you how. For the last 9 years, I've dedicated my career to repackaging lady sadness into digestible comedy so that we can all be a little smarter and a little savvier and can laugh together at the insane ways people try to control us. For the past 7 years, I've been the co-host of the absurdist political comedy podcast, Throwing Shade, where I've been talking shit about Mike Pence since he was just a small-time, rat-eyed, worm-man governor of Indiana. The time I've spent reading about his anti-choice state legislation is more than I've invested in getting my brows waxed, and I am very punctual with my facial hair maintenance. On the show, I've covered women's issues from Catholic hospitals' subpar treatment of black mothers to female students being kicked out of proms for wearing suits to the WNBA pay gap. Throwing Shade wasn't my first job verbally eviscerating the worst of the worst. As a political writer director at Funny or Die, Michelle Bachman, Megyn Kelly, Michelle Duggar, Jan Brewer, Mitt and Ann Romney, and the entire state of Utah made making fun of them too easy. But I truly owe my career to my first job in political comedy. As the host of Modern Lady, a segment on the TV show Infomania, I researched the shitty trends of women in the media, like female cops all being victims of a crime or celebrity breastfeeding shaming, and made them funny. Or tried to, at least. You haven't seen my An Independent Girl's Guide to Valentine's Day segment, and you never will. My transformation into a childless, career-obsessed, nail-biting, hell-bent feminist she-devil banshee was not easy or fast. It took me 20 years of soul-crushing defeats completely tied to my gender. When I was 8 years old and standing a cool adult height of 5'9" in the third grade, I was a lovable, joy-filled dork who found the inner confidence to rock pink geometric Garfield glasses and size 10 adult hot pink Reebok high tops. As a kid, I had my head in the clouds, dreaming of being the next Steven Spielberg, dreams that were effortlessly crushed by teachers who didn't have the imagination to consider a woman just as capable of standing behind a camera and bossing people around while the director of photography does all the work. In junior high, having never grown into my massive feet, I tried to be acceptably cool, not the way I want to be cool, by getting contact lenses, which allowed me to see that even without glasses, I was still a gangly geek with a bad home perm who played the clarinet and wore paisley MC Hammer pants. I was made fun of, had chronic nosebleeds, and was known for farting as I tripped up the gym bleachers. Shitty preteens made fun of my nose hairs, told me I was ugly, and one seventh grade boy threatened to murder me in science class once a week in graphic detail. My sister was also having a hard time, so we held our own school dances in the yard space under our A-frame's deck, and a trickling of other white trash children would wander over after WrestleMania to eat pigs in a blanket and dance to CNC Music Factory. I stumbled through high school an unfuckable dork, and in college I blossomed into a functional alcoholic with a sporadic sex life and a complicated eating disorder that involved taking daily double doses of appetite suppressants, drinking Starbucks venti vanilla lattes, and smoking more cigarettes than Humphrey Bogart and Kristen Stewart combined. I wanted to go to college to study photography, but was scared people would think I was weird. I was weird. I am weird. So I got a useless marketing degree. I was on a very specific life track, a track that ensured I would marry the first guy who was nice enough to hold my chunky highlighted hair as I vomited spaghetti and vodka into my Nine West pumps in front of the dumpster behind Club Europa. Then we'd have three terrible children, all of them different combinations of the worst things about both of us. He'd have the nerve to divorce me at 45, and I'd be relegated to taking my kids to soccer practice, wearing oversized t-shirts printed with things like, "I gave him the skinniest years of my life," while watching him and his new girlfriend, a 25-year-old Toyota repair shop receptionist named Molly with two E's, feed each other corn dogs in the bleachers. But before I headed down that path, my feminist Jesus carried me on the beach of life just when I needed her. Tria Wood, a fierce, independent feminist, came into my life and set me on another road. She gave me a copy of Susan Faludi's Backlash, which I read in 3 days, which is fast for me. Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Took me 3 weeks. Thank you very much. The book unraveled the suppressive gender sweater I'd been sweating in my whole life. I stopped hating myself and other women and redirected my rage at the dumbass, cis, straight white men in authority who were ruining my life with their power, religion, wealth, and sex eyes. I started figuring out who I wanted to be and erasing the person I thought people wanted me to be. I came up with a really good personality for myself. A charming, funny bitch who wants to destroy the status quo by any means necessary, as long as RuPaul's Drag Race is not on. A powerful alpha female who will figuratively stick her high heels in the patriarchy's nutsack while eating a slice of margarita pizza. An unapologetic cunt who corrects any dude who thinks she gives a shit about his stupid, uninformed, unsolicited opinion. A feminasty. Chapter 1. The Terrifying Prospect of Mike, Vaginas Are the Devil's Mouth Flaps, Pence. When I was 10 years old, all I wanted to do was listen to Def Leppard, Mary Doogie Howser, and be old enough to smoke cigarettes. We had just moved to Ironton, Ohio, from Texas, and I had no friends. My favorite thing to do was take pictures of my baby dolls in dangerous situations, like hanging them by one toe from an elm tree, or placing their head under a car wheel. I was a busy child auteur, living in my own bubble world, and the last place I wanted to be wasting my creative time was Sunday morning at Catholic Church, listening as a priest made the story of a man with incredible powers mind-numbingly boring. The only exciting thing that ever happened in church was being filled with absolute jealousy at all those braggers who got to take communion. Not me. I wasn't in the Cracker of Christ Club. Sure, I wanted watered-down grape juice and paper-like crackers because I was hungry. But I wasn't allowed bland, early St. Lawrence brunch because my mom didn't let me take catechism classes. We went out of a sense of duty and ritual, but there was something holding my mom back from leaving me there to learn from those people. She is justifiably scarred, having gone to Catholic school along with her 10 brothers and sisters, until one of the nuns hit my Uncle Freddy and my grandpa pulled them all out temporarily. Sister Clematis, known in my family as Pennywise in a Habit, would take a wooden ruler and slam it on my 6-year-old mother's tiny little lady hands for coloring outside the lines. Chew on a pencil? Get nun slapped in the back of the head. Be restless in your chair, and she would give you a warm hug and tell you it's going to be okay. Just kidding. She would sneak up behind you and rattle your chair like a hurricane. Father Fraley drove a Corvette, which he parked by the children's playground, and then would go ape if their kickballs bounced into his holy muscle car. And I would be filled with regret if I didn't mention Monsignor York's yearly all-boys trip to Myrtle Beach. Just an innocent romp to a beach city co-ed.com named the number 12 trashiest spring break destination. But we still went to church, taking all that into consideration and whatever else my family doesn't talk about, because that's what you did. My grandmother Norma Bell was a devout Catholic, having converted to marry my grandfather, who was a first-generation Irish Catholic street rat. I'm a third-generation Irish street rat, and if you want proof, look at my ears and my hair when it dries naturally. I look like an extra in once. Norma Bell was raised Southern Baptist, and they let it be known with death threats that they didn't approve of her jumping onto ship Catholic. Slowly, over a long period of time, my family stopped putting up with the church bullshit. They woke up from the spell and Kool-Aid Man through the buttressed walls, running backward, middle fingers up. I actually owe the Catholic Church a lot. If they hadn't been absolutely terrible to my family, I would have never developed a mafia-like hatred for them. You mess with my family, Pope, you mess with me. An adult woman who is always showing up at birthday parties, dressed in the same clothes as the toddlers. Who I dislike more than the church are the religious posers who take the parables of the Bible and use them as a weapon to hurt and control women. They're like a Christian mullet. Religion in the front, evil in the back. Now, I'm not saying all Christians are assholes. There are certainly good ones out there. Maybe you're a good person, and you also happen to believe that a virgin can give birth. I can accept that. I think that plants will share the secrets of the universe if I touch them while I'm on DMT. We all believe weird stuff. But here's what I'm not fucking standing for. Hypocritical behavior. Not from Christian minister and GOP superstar Mike Huckabee, who went on Fox News and compared women's health clinic Planned Parenthood to a heroin dealer. I'm not taking it from Wisconsin State Assembly GOP rep and Catholic Roger Rivard, who said, "Some girls, they rape so easy." And I'm definitely not taking it from King Religious Ding Dong, husband to mother, and analog phone enthusiast Mike Pence. Mike Pence is the Vice President of the United States, and he's someone I am very worried might become the most powerful man in the Western world. There's a lot of pressure to get Donald Trump out of the White House. But the man who would then be president is much worse. Trump can at least be tricked into doing sort of the right thing for a day. But Pence has been applying his steadfast religious anti-woman dogma since 1999. R.I.P. Prince. Mike Pence started sharing his moral oppression of females in the late 90s, tackling one of the biggest threats to his worldview, Disney's Mulan. Maybe you haven't seen it, because you're busy searching for pictures of baby animal enemies falling asleep holding each other. So let me explain the plot. The movie's about a young woman who pretends to be her father in order to enlist in the Chinese army. When they find out she's a woman, they spare her life, even though it's a crime punishable by death. She later sneaks into the emperor's palace, disguised as a concubine, and rescues everyone. Mike Pence wasn't upset about the implied sex slavery or executions. No. He felt the movie would radicalize women into thinking they could serve in combat, which was not permitted at the time. Just to be clear, he was so mad after seeing a cartoon girl become a war hero, he opened up Word 97 and started typing a diatribe that even Paperclip Helper Clippy was like, Are you sure you want to type this ridiculous shit? When he was done, he posted it on the website for his radio show, The Mike Pence Show. Or, let's be real, someone else uploaded it to his website. I believe Mike Pence knows HTML like I believe Johnny Depp volunteers at a women's shelter. While Pence set out to air his opposition to women serving in combat, he took the opportunity to say that women shouldn't be in the military at all. He wrote, "The hard truth of our experiment with gender integration is that it has been an almost complete disaster for the military and for many of the individual women involved." Mike Pence sounds like a pirate with scurvy to me. An adult man triggered by a Disney movie. This children's entertainment is a threat to our military system, and he's the only patriot red, white, and blue enough to say it. On the outside, yeah, he's a red, white, and blue patriot who thinks women are precious porcelain dolls Jesus gift-wrapped for men to impregnate while we Clorox shower tiles. But on the inside, he's scared of us. And he doesn't want us to have guns in the Sunni Triangle because we might discover the real enemy is our country. Or he's scared that little girls might grow up to feel that they are capable of doing anything a man can do. Whatever he's afraid of, he's afraid. And he might make you believe this outrage-wrapped fear is justified by referencing in his piece that women are sexually assaulted in the military. He specifically references what he calls the tailhook scandal, which is, according to him, an incident involving scores of high-ranking Navy fighter pilots who molested subordinate women. For the purposes of this chapter, I'd love to use different language that paints a clearer picture of what tailhook was. I'd like to refer to it as the ultimate gang rape at tailhook, a living hellscape where 83 women and 7 men were sexually assaulted by more than 100 officers. Pence is afraid that Mulan will send a message to little girls that you won't get raped in the American military, and he knows that's not true. Mike Pence could have used Mulan as a paradigm for what the U.S. military could be, where women are treated with respect, and not just reiterated the un-Jesus-like way the military actually treats women and men. Take rape out of the equation, and Mike Pence still thinks women have no business in the military. He type screams, "Housing in close quarters, young men and women, in some cases married to non-military personnel, at the height of their physical and sexual potential, is the height of stupidity." Don't you picture him saying this while chugging an A&W root beer on the back of a plugged-in golf car that's sitting in the middle of the garage? Surrounded by unused tools and his pals, 4 old white guys wearing varying translations of blue polos. You know, the kind of guys who excuse themselves to fart outside, but still cover it up with a too loud cough, just in case. Mike Pence would say, "Guys, you know how children's cartoons get you thinking about how sexually explosive 18-year-old soldiers are." His friend would reply,
"Yeah, sure, Mike."
Confused looks all around. Kip Tupper, a real estate mogul and prayer buddy, snaps off a bite of celery and swallows it aggressively. This might be a long night. I know Mike Pence because Mike Pence is every dad I grew up around in Texas. My friend Avery's dad used to drink Natural Light with us in his garage and talk about how women shouldn't be cops. Well, his exact words were, "I hate bitch cops." And then he'd make a hard left turn into some Rain Man-like regurgitation of pages of scripture. The experience is like enjoying the whimsy of the It's a Small World ride 1 second, and then the next, you're in a whiskey barrel about to go over Niagara Falls. Think Mike Pence is only focused on destroying the lives of men and women at the height of their physical and sexual potential. He's also given your grandma a nice 1-2 punch in the crotch when he tried to pay for Katrina relief by cutting Medicare. Yes, he cut the budget that assists the old mothers and fathers we should be honoring in order to pay for the blessed poor. Because the Bible has all those passages about, "Thou shalt never cut the warmongering budget to help the helpless." Either group he chooses not to help, he's hurting good Christians. Like the best Christian who ever lived, my grandma, Norma Bell Thompson. She wore a rosary, prayed before every meal, never missed Mass, and gave money she couldn't afford to give to the church. She made me biscuits and gravy even when it was clear I was getting fat. She laughed when I cussed. She took in homeless people, and she loved everyone exactly the same. When I was 10, sitting on Grandma's porch, reading Bridge to Terabithia again, while my cousin Stephanie and her Filipino boyfriend made out, a neighbor walked by and abruptly directed a racial slur towards Stephanie's boyfriend, and my grandma came flying out of the screen door and went ham on that guy. She was screaming, "Jesus doesn't discriminate in this house!" Mike Pence could learn a lesson from Norma Thompson. If someone told my grandma they were gay, she would hold them and squeeze them into her double D boobs and tell them they were loved. She wouldn't do everything in her power to destroy them using the Bible as her weapon. As governor of Indiana, Mike Pence diverted funds from the state's Ryan White Care Act, the largest federally funded program to assist people living with HIV and AIDS, and put that money into conversion therapy facilities. At best, conversion therapy is like going to camp for a week where adults yell at you to force you to be straight. At worst, it's like going to a camp for a week where adults yell and hit you to force you to be straight. It doesn't fucking work at changing someone's sexual orientation, and the American Medical Association and the American Psychological Association both agree it's awful. Both oppose conversion therapy because it's attempting to fix something that's not wrong, oftentimes using psychologically and sometimes physically violent methods. Only 12 states in the United States ban conversion therapy, and Mike Pence's state is not one of them. Neither does Louisiana, a state that housed a legal conversion camp that took one of my best friends away. During college, I was working at America's finest chino retailer, The Gap. The floor manager found out very quickly that my perfectionist anxiety was uniquely suited for the fitting room. And that's where I stayed for 2 years, stuck in a windowless hallway, repeating the same greetings, and folding the same reasonably priced separates again and again and again. Most of the people who worked with me were high school kids who only had the job because they were bored. They would stand in my 3x4 foot work box and refuse to put back clothes. But then, there was hope. She was a 25-year-old social worker from a small town in Louisiana who worked at The Gap for extra money. She was loud and sweet and loved to put people in their place. She called everyone baby doll. And when she came into my glorified closet, it was for jokes and to help. We were inseparable. After work on Saturdays, we'd get drunk at P.F. Chang's, go to the gay clubs, smoke a ton of cigarettes, then get up on Sunday and watch Meet the Press. One night, she took me out for a non-PFC Chinese dinner and nervously blurted out to me that she was a lesbian. I don't think she expected me to squeal with joy and then squeal even louder when she told me she'd been dating our queer hairdresser. I was so excited for both of them. When the three of us would go out, I could feel how happy they both were. And bonus, since Hope was hotter than me, it meant way more dick for this lady. Everyone wins! Then, out of nowhere, Hope disappeared. I didn't know where she was. Her girlfriend hadn't heard from her in days. Neither of us knew her parents. She never really talked about them much, so we couldn't call them. Then, one day, she emailed us to tell us her parents had come to rescue her and put her in a place with people who could help her figure things out. Her email read like a letter from someone sucked into a cult. "I'm safe here with the Branch Davidians. David may be a megalomaniac who thinks he's Jesus, but don't worry. There are also plenty of guns." She said she wasn't a lesbian anymore. She was never a lesbian, just confused. I never heard from Hope again. I've lost her email since I abandoned Adidas69@hotmail.com, an address I hope a corn fan is putting to good use. Wherever Hope is, I hope she's okay. These Christian conversion centers are not only dangerous, but when you're put there by your family, you have very few options of finding someone to help you escape them, which is why they should be illegal. Because honestly, what's worse in the eyes of the Lord? Bringing a snake to Mardi Gras, which is illegal in Louisiana, or forcing a teenager to watch lesbian porn and then hitting her whenever two women have sex, which is legal in Louisiana. When he's not busy voting against the minimum wage, making low-level offenders stay in jail forever, or defunding Syrian refugee rescue groups in his state, Pence is using his impenetrable armor of religion to roll back reproductive rights. He's tried to redefine rape as forcible or not forcible. He's signed laws to shut down abortion clinics. He's encouraged women with non-viable pregnancies to carry them to term. And worst of the worst, he's forced women to pay for the burial of fetal remains after abortion procedures or after she's had a miscarriage. And on the seventh day, Christ rose and told a grieving woman to wipe her tears and fork over $1,500 for the burial costs. You're probably thinking, how does Mike Pence find the time to hate so many kinds of women and keep his skin looking so young? Well, I have it on good authority. He ritualistically sneaks into prison births to soak his skin in newborn Vernix while watching the mother shackled to her hospital bed. It's the only thing keeping that turkey neck in check. His nastiness comes directly from the edicts of the Evangelical Church, which he joined in college. According to an election piece the New York Times did on Pence, he was enamored with one of his frat brother's gold cross necklaces when his brother said to him, "Remember, Mike, you've got to wear it in your heart before you wear it around your neck." And then he was at a Christian music festival in Kentucky, which we'll go ahead and call Godchella, where he gave his life to Jesus Christ. So Mike Pence found extreme Christianity because of a shiny necklace and shrooms. According to a study by the Public Religion Research Institute, white evangelical Christians, compared to other religious groups, think they are more persecuted than any other sect, which is supremely delusional considering they are dictating the terms of American politics. Mike Pence makes laws that hurt other people because he feels his faith is under attack. Because in his Christian worldview, the freedom of women and minorities and LGBTQI people is an attack on Christianity. So he has to be a bad Christian to protect his Christian life of being a nice person. If he's a true Christian in the purest sense of the idea, he'd downsize from his state-subsidized Tudor-style home filled with silk shantung armchairs into a modest home, or at the very least, give his butler, which the state of Indiana pays for, a day off. But the reality is, Mike Pence and his wife Karen's freedoms aren't under attack. Their way of life is not threatened. The truth is, they don't have many problems. Karen has so few problems in her life, she has to make them up, which is why she invented, "That's my towel!" towel charm. Karen is concerned with so many things. The death of babies at abortion factories. Gay people marrying. But she's focused much of her time on this absolutely relatable global crisis. On her website, she writes, "I've had so many times where I was swimming at a friend's beach house, pool, or lake house, using their matching beautiful beach towels. Lo and behold, I would go in the water for a dip or up to the house for a beverage. And when I came back to my towel, it was gone! Someone else had grabbed my towel unknowingly because all of the towels look the same. A problem everyone can relate to. Oh, I have so many friends who own second properties near water, and I can't even keep up with my friends who have a pool at their home. God, I must know thousands. And all of my very busy women friends can always find the time to buy extra matching towels just for the pool. So thank goodness Karen has solved a massive problem that exists for so few rich people by inventing a tiny fucking charm you stab into your towel so that Trisha's son can stop fucking using yours. They look like what you'd imagine. Tiny sailboats and seagulls and sunglasses. Just kidding! They're shaped like French fries, cameras, and trains! I bet if Karen were on Christian Mingle, she'd have those listed under her interests. Hi, I'm Karen, Christian fanatic who loves the finest things in life. Cameras, French fries, and trains! Looking for a strong Joseph type with an aversion to the poor and a passion for the Christ. Get it? LOL. Ah! P.S. I love to LOL. Mike Pence is not a Christian. He is a religious terrorist who now has a lot of power to do a lot of terrible things to people in this country who need a helping hand from a good Christian. If Jesus were alive today, first of all, he would look exactly like the beardiest version of the Abbott brothers. And secondly, if he were the leper-loving, bread-multiplying, poor-serving saint the Bible claims he was, he would have some strong words and disappointing headshakes for Mike Pence as he tells him, "You're not welcome in my faith, you piece of shit." Impeaching Trump is not the answer, because the next bozo in line is a guy who thinks The Handmaid's Tale is a wish-fulfillment fantasy, like Field of Dreams, but with more state-sanctioned rape. We wait out their term while helping women who are in the crosshairs of their villainous laws. Then we flush them out with a tsunami of overqualified women who won't forget what they did to us. These men will never dry off, no matter how many becharmed towels Karen Pence hands them. Chapter 2. How to Explain Hashtag MeToo to the Dummies Who Don't Get It. The year 2017 was shit. No. It was worse than shit. It was taking a shit in a porta potty at a food festival while a forklift turns it upside down. It was doused in gallons of Kogi taco diarrhea, forcefully expelled cheese curds, and pad thai soft stool, then sent to an unair-conditioned storage facility in the Antelope Valley on an unseasonably hot day. Open the door and take a whiff. That was 2017. Caked on human shit smothered in throw-up, fermented to perfection. It was a year of constant nuclear war threats, government shutdowns, and a stock market more erratic than Shia LaBeouf's performance art manifesto. But despite the rank BM that is our political reality, some really amazing things happened for women. Wonder Woman was the highest-grossing movie by a female director ever. I was able to find a pair of jeans that didn't suffocate my labia. And Tarana Burke's hashtag MeToo movement woke people up to the novel idea that female bodies aren't jungle gyms for pervs. The toppling of the patriarchy was in full swing. Sure, it was going on against a backdrop of imminent nuclear war, but it was happening! The problem is, amid the celebratory, "My rape kit is being processed!" brunches, and "I got my handsy boss fired after 10 years, bar parties, we didn't stop to think about what we stand to lose, according to people who never wanted Me Too to happen. Here's what they won't shut up about. Number 1. Me Too is ruining masculinity! No one believes this harder than Fox News online scribe and circus pony Suzanne Venker. It's an understatement to say Suzanne dislikes feminism, considering she writes articles titled, "Is Equality Ruining Your Marriage?" and the right to the point, "Society is creating a new crop of alpha women who are unable to love." A better way to put it might be, Suzanne Venker wishes she could single white female feminism right in the eye with a stiletto. Suzanne is passionate about a lot of things. Chunky bright necklaces, cropped Spanish teacher haircuts, and destroying the slow progress feminists have made because they've ruined her 1950s nuclear family fever dream. By the way, this is the first of many references to chunky necklaces in this book. They are mostly worn by terrible women who think their vaguely ethnic, colorful, heavy neck decor is a personality. Mentioning them is part of my brand. Get into it. If we had it Suzanne's way, women would still be spending their days re-vacuuming the same spot in the living room while wearing cone bras. You know, like malfunctioning fembots. The only feminist thing Suzanne has ever done is watch Leave It to Beaver. And I'm sure the double entendre escaped her. Side note, if you're a woman running for office, I'd like to encourage you to use Leave It to Beaver as your campaign slogan. You want a candidate for change? Well then, leave it to Beaver! It should come as no surprise then that Suzanne was pissed about Me Too. So she did what she does best, slamming her French manicured tips under her Dell desktop, pressing send on her Juno.net email, and releasing a scathing anti-Me Too piece to whatever Jabba the Hutt lookalike runs Fox News these days. In keeping with her saying it all with the title naming technique, she called it, Me Too isn't about sexual harassment. It's about destroying masculinity. Like any other Pulitzer-worthy reporter, Suzanne is kind enough to explain the Me Too movement in terms her audience will understand. She writes, But grievances are like crabgrass. The more heat they get, the more it spreads. Crabgrass. Yeah, it's the perfect analogy for readers whose number one life problem is lawn aeration. What I like about this analogy is that it uses a logic applying to lots of stuff besides crabgrass. The thing about grievances is they're a lot like Toll House cookie dough. The more heat they get, the more they spread. She goes on to say, The current outcry against men in power has nothing to do with giving a voice to victims. It's about putting feminists in power. What would feminists do with this power? Destroy all that is left of men and masculinity, among other things. Among what other things? I don't have time for other things. I'm chock-a-block dropping men off on Lord of the Flies Island. In all seriousness, I tell my husband Ollie, when the feminist revolution comes, I will visit him on Man Island. One or two times a year. But it won't be all bad. Think about all the pals he can talk about Bitcoin with. Suzanne doesn't lay out how we'll get this immense power or when it'll come to us, but I really want to know. Like, will we get a card in the mail or a phone call? Is it like Publishers Clearing House? Will a group of people in suits with balloons ring our doorbell and tell us we have it? Suzanne doesn't seem to have the slightest idea what feminists will do to get this power, but she knows one thing for certain. At the end of the day, what feminists want is a whole new America. And they will band together until they get it. I don't need a whole new America. Okay, yeah, it would be nice to live in a world where men don't graze my butt on their way to grab the 35-pound free weights. But I want to keep some parts of America. Weed lemonade. Miss Vangie. Interesting ankle boots and Maxine Waters exactly as they are. What Suzanne means by a whole new America is an America where the rules are different, where the rules are female, which panics her. What would Suzanne do when we feminize the system and we eliminate homelessness, run the banks that don't fail, and institute massive tax write-offs for waxing, highlights, and BB cream, all while requiring a mandatory 3 days off for periods? Building a system of child care providers and outlawing fringe jackets on men with ponytails. Suzanne is probably the type of person who had a nervous breakdown when MasterCard changed its logo. She can't handle a new world order, even one that benefits her. Number two. Me Too is devastating sexy Hollywood movies! The Hollywood Reporter's Tatiana Siegel is another woman bravely standing up on behalf of the status quo. In her article, How the Me Too Movement Could Kill Some Sexy Hollywood Movies, she argues that the third installment of 50 Shades of Grey may be its last, thanks to Me Too. Now, I've seen the first 50 Shades of Grey, and let me tell you, it's a joke to call it erotica. I get that 50 Shades author E.L. Fudge wets her Haynes panties at the idea of an emotionally broken Christian Grey coming at her in his dumpy Tommy Hilfiger jeans. But I am not so H.O. If my options were to either let the Hilfiger jeans guy jerk me off with a horse whip or be cursed to live as a chain wallet belonging to the lead singer of a Christian rock band for the rest of my life, I would choose the latter. If the Me Too movement means women's boundaries are respected and I never have to see a 50 Shades poster on a bus stop again, it's collateral damage I can get behind. The 50 Shades movie franchise needs to make like a cum tissue and be flushed down the toilet. Or like what happens in my house, get eaten by my dog. Don't worry, I always fish it out of his mouth before he swallows it. And you'll never guess what other art house films are on the chopping block because of Me Too. Just look at how Louis C.K.'s hot intergenerational romance, I Love You Daddy, was censored by meanie film distributors just because Louis C.K. jerked off in front of women in the past, completely ignoring that the movie was, at its core, a heaping pile of old boner intellectualism in the first place. It's not fair! Then there was the Hugh Hefner biopic starring Jared Leto, a movie not going forward even though they did the right thing and fired gloppy fried coconut shrimp buffet Brett Ratner. Isn't it sad we won't get to know what brand of baby oil Hugh Hefner used on his old lizard dick? Mmm! Thanks a lot, Me Too! Number 3. Me Too has wrecked lunches with my grandpa. I took my grandpa to Red Lobster for his birthday. We were having a nice time, enjoying our Cheddar Bay biscuits and seahorse-sized shrimps, when he asked me what I thought of the Me Too movement. I told him it was about making people aware of what kind of abuse women endure, and he said, well, you should have been there in Korea. People did crazy stuff and everyone was okay with it. Then I said, okay, so a commanding officer grabbed your balls and told you if you didn't suck his dick, you'd be on latrine duty? And he said, no. No, that would be awful. Then he got quiet and lost himself in his admiral's feast. That entire lunch cost me $35 and he learned nothing. Number 4, Me Too is alienating older women. 100 famous French women signed a letter in Le Monde expressing their concern about the Me Too movement, which used the much more punk French hashtag, expose your pig, or en français, balance ton porc. Thank you. I took one full semester of French. My name was Chantal, and I got a D. The letter involved all of the famous French Catherines, art critic Catherine Millet, writer Catherine Robbe-Grillet, and 60s ingenue Catherine Deneuve, expressing their various issues with the movement. Like that it reeks of Stalinist thought policing, and the antiquated notion that women are babies who need protecting. The Catherines saw the Grand Canyon-sized chasm between second-wave feminists and younger women who'd simply prefer not to have male coworkers touch their ass creases while they're standing over the copy machine, and they added a moat. Also, can you believe we still use copy machines? Why? Here's what I'd like to say to that generation of women. Shh, it's okay now. You don't have to put up with it. Put on your patent leather white go-go boots and kick them square into the nuts of the old men who were awful to you. We've got your back. And Deneuve, don't worry about your age. We've got Ryan Murphy now. He's got an imperious opium-addicted swinger club owner role with your name on it. This line of criticism is also animating the debate stateside. It seasons Daphne Merkin's New York Times opinion piece. Publicly, we say Me Too. Privately, we have misgivings. Daphne's general thesis is, Me Too is getting out of control, and I knew I was going to hate this piece after reading the first sentence. You can be sure that this weekend at the Golden Globes, Hollywood celebrities, not exactly known for their independent thinking, will turn the red carpet into a Me Too moment replete with designer duds. Oh, cool start to your piece, making your case by insulting an entire category of women. I've had the pleasure of working with some amazing actresses who are way smarter than me. Sure, there are ding-dongs here and there, but isn't that true of any profession? I worked with a guy at The Gap who was doomed to work the floor because he wasn't smart enough to work the cash register. A machine where the key's functions were labeled explicitly. Want to process a return? Push the return button. Dude couldn't handle it! If you're going to shit on famous people for being sheeple, stick to reality stars. Except Lisa Vanderpump and Erica Jane. Daphne, a time traveler from the year 2050, when men have become enslaved and are only allowed out of their cages to use as virile sperminators, goes on to make the following assertions in her opinion piece. Assertion number 1. This tactless sense of outrage will sweep up a bunch of innocent men in the process, dooming them to heresy. This aligns with other, more unhinged arguments against Me Too. Like the idea that women are wantonly guillotining good guys for the sheer joy of it, which have no basis in reality. Look, if all accusers were really so comfortable outing their perps' dirty laundry, Hollywood and nearly every other industry would cease to exist overnight. I'm surprised there haven't been more accusations, is what I'm saying. The idea that this movement has gone too far is like a bag of Lady Doritos. I'm not buying it. Assertion number two. The following passage, wherein she describes the dissonance between the public cheers at another fallen sexual predator and what happens when we're all in private. In private, it's a different story. Grow up! This is real life, I hear these same feminist friends say. Whatever happened to flirting? And what about the women who are the predators? Some women, including random people I talk to in supermarket lines, have gone so far as to call it an outright witch hunt. Excuse me, I know we're just two strangers standing in line to buy cotton candy grapes, but do you think the Me Too movement is a witch hunt? Also, can we please start using the term witch hunt correctly? A witch hunt is when a woman is drowned for her ability to do math. Assertion number three. She says that Garrison Keillor and Al Franken have been victims of trickle-down Me Too vitriol. We don't want to admit it, but sometimes the lefty males we love, who seem to be doing the right thing, are actually shitty people. And I don't think a movement should be blamed for reacting to evidence of our friends being assholes. Assertion number four. Flirting is over. She laments the lack of clarity around what exactly sexual harassment is. She innocently asks, is kissing someone an affection, however inappropriately, or showing someone a photo of a nude male torso necessarily predatory behavior? The answer to all of that is yes! Let's use Daphne's examples of what is appropriate flirting to show how predatory it is in this hypothetical playlet. Steve, the marketing manager, walks into his subordinate Nicole's cubicle.
Sorry to bother you, Nicole. I know you're working hard on a spreadsheet for today's quarterly marketing meeting, but can you quickly look at this picture of my bare torso and tell me if it's too shiny from lotion?
Then Steve French kisses her ear. Here's the question we should be asking. Why does flirting have to be so fucking skeevy? Why can't guys pay compliments to women without any expectations and then see what happens? If guys would hit the fucking brakes more often on their fast and furious flirting tactics, no one would have to guess if the line between what's comfortable and uncomfortable has been crossed. Assertion number five. And this is the most ignorant sentence in this whole piece. She says, but I don't believe that scattershot, life-destroying denunciations are the way to upend it. Daphne, where were you when these women were having their lives destroyed by these situations? Where was your think piece when they were losing their jobs, their safety? Don't you see that all other systems have failed them? That HR managers have ignored their accounts repeatedly for years? Daphne thinks it's our responsibility, not just to defend ourselves, but to make sure the guys who are guilty of sexual assault are protected. The only protection they need now is from women's fists and our weird pointy rings. Assertion number six, the return of the victim paradigm. This is the most cited reason these women are against Me Too. It's the idea that Me Too is exploiting a new strain of feminism, tying being a woman to being a victim. That by talking about our assaults, we are shattering the illusion that women are strong as hell. But I see Me Too exposing the opposite. Every fucking day, I see another courageous woman taking to Twitter or Instagram to let us know there's a new asshole on the block. Do you know how fucking brave that is? I see the victimology paradigm not as exposing the crime perpetrated against you, but rather believing your only choice is to stay silent. This is going to sound like a left turn, but I assure you it's not. If I lived in a Hudson Valley farmhouse and I demolished a wall and I found some old newspaper in that wall and it was this article that Daphne wrote and it was dated 1884, I would have said, yeah, you go, Daphne. This piece would have been revolutionary in a time when half the country was still shitting outdoors. But reading it now, it feels like the ideas of an out-of-touch literary snob who doesn't like seeing her elite male friends go down in the fires they started. Daphne is taking her shovel and digging the trench between generations of feminists a little deeper and wider with this piece. There was not one single piece of information on how she thinks men could change their behavior and create fewer problems. Only that women are creating more problems. To which I say, ding dong, you're wrong, you stupid bitch. Number 5. The Me Too movement is humiliating Aziz Ansari. Aziz Ansari, for those of you who don't know, is the star of Master of None, wherein he plays an actor navigating his 30s in New York City. First of all, let me say I find it indicative of a comedian's lack of creativity when they get their own TV show and can't come up with another job for them to have on it. Oh, you're a comedian in real life and you're playing a comedian on TV? Revolutionary. Must be why you got into entertainment, huh? To really expand your imagination? Look at it this way. Kevin James played a UPS delivery guy. When Paul Blart Mall Cop is finding more inventive ways to package comedic storytelling, maybe try harder, indie comedians. So Aziz is called out by a woman, who goes by Grace, for ignoring her verbal and nonverbal boundaries during an evening they spent together. Babe.net, truly the Paris Review of feminist clickbait, broke the story in a slapped-together garbage article that did a bad job of handling the nuances of why the story is important. But even though Babe.net did think it was important to mention exactly what kind of wine Grace ordered before Aziz got handsy, and was super lurid about all the sex moves he used, it was still breathtaking to watch how quickly critics pounced on the piece. The Atlantic's Caitlin Flanagan said that the Aziz hit job only painted women as angry, temporarily powerful, and very, very dangerous. Caitlin couldn't wrap her mind around why Grace wouldn't leave if she didn't feel safe, writing, "Apparently there's a whole country full of young women who don't know how to call a cab." I once slept with a guy on a first date because he was too drunk to drive me home, and I didn't know how to call a cab or even where I was. I'd only been living in Chicago for a few weeks after moving there from the suburbs of Houston, where I had learned how to overpluck my eyebrows, but not how to leave uncomfortable sexual scenarios, or that I was even allowed to. And I'm not the only woman I know who has slept with someone because it felt like the only option. Although, it wasn't all bad. He did take me to a really good play about the Holocaust. But Aaron, what about Uber? What about Lyft? You scream into the pages. Well, last time I checked, those things still cost money. One time I was stuck at the Addison L station, desperately trying to withdraw cash from my credit card so I could ride the train home. The machine informed me I was maxed out. So for 45 minutes, I speed walked toward my apartment at 3 a.m. Headline News' Ashley Banfield said this situation sounded less like sexual assault and more like a bad date. And then she said some more stuff about the story not belonging in the Me Too movement. Then the reporter behind the story clapped back, calling Ashley a burgundy lipstick, bad highlight, second wave feminist. Which is not cool. We all know the only woman who should be shamed for her highlights is burning menthol cigarette on a tanning bed Jan Brewer. Those are the rules. It's a shame everyone is so focused on the issue of whether or not Grace's experience matters in the landscape of Me Too, instead of discussing the whole reason Grace came forward. She saw a man participating in a women's movement who had straight up ignored her consent. Was she supposed to simply shield her eyes while he swanned down red carpets with a Time's Up lapel pin? It makes me furious that women have to experience these things, which is why I have to take very violent workout classes at least 3 times a week. Kettlebell kickboxing, yoga for murderers, Pilates and punching. Me Too is about the myriad ways straight men are failing us. Not just by being predators like Harvey Weinstein, but also by ignoring our consent in seemingly smaller ways too. It's about men disregarding our boundaries in intimate situations because they've been taught every dick move is fair in the search for a mate. Like we're all just exotic fauna on their hunting safari. What the people who are so scared of Me Too need to realize is the goal isn't to limit sex or discourage men from doing their men stuff like MMA and long conversations about paleo diets. Me Too is about our complaints being heard for the first time and taken seriously. What some see as the collective anger of 1,000 wronged women, I see as the expression of frustration and hurt. Me Too is about making sure women are not operating out of sheer terror for their own safety. It's about telling the office clown, Chase, it's not cool or normal to send porn gifts at the end of Slack convos. We're envisioning a better world. One where Justin Timberlake won't tweet, here we come, and damn, my wife is hot. Hashtag time's up. Hashtag why we wear black. Sloppily mixing male objectification with a hashtag designed to make people aware of lopsided sexual power dynamics. A new world where Justin Timberlake uses the hashtag time's up and then also feels shame for starring in Woody Allen's Wonder Wheel. A world where Justin Timberlake refuses to do the Super Bowl halftime show without Janet Jackson. A world where Justin Timberlake is actually funny and not just a guy in a wig making funny faces. And in this world, we won't just have the perfect iteration of Justin Timberlake, one who takes a step back once in a while and lets JC Chazet shine. Women will feel strong and safe in a world where our boundaries are respected. Also, I promise you, there will be a lot more fucking. Then just wait until we move on to the phase where all men are actually taught just how sensitive a clitoris can be, or it doesn't make you less of a man to take a finger up the ass. Watch as the whole planet becomes a straight-up, safe, consensual fuckfest. Chapter 3. Watch out for these backstabbing bitches. It's 5:30 p.m. and I'm standing outside my sister's bedroom window, my jewel-toned kaleidoscope keyhole unitard drenched with sweat. At some point between before-school cigarettes in the parking lot of Cypress Falls High School, go Eagles! Just kidding, I don't care. And after-school drill team dance practice, I've lost my house keys. I'm begging my younger sister Audrey to let me in. We're 14 months apart. Irish twins, as my mom likes to say, which is really just a nice way of saying, oops, we bake too much. My sister and I could barely tolerate each other. So when one of us needed help, the other was all too happy to stand by, holding a life preserver lit on fire. It's a typical dynamic among sisters. Be ruthless and competitive and nasty because you're fighting for a limited amount of attention and resources. At least that was the case between us. My parents won't be home for at least 3 hours. Audrey knows this, and she's enjoying her powerful position as gatekeeper. My friend Brooke is there, watching all of it. She has a brother, and they love each other, so she doesn't get it. But she doesn't want to leave until I get inside. All I want is a shower. I spent 2 hours in the blazing Texas sun doing step ball changes to a dance remix of Toto's Africa, a song about 15 years past its prime, but was getting the resurgence it didn't deserve thanks to some asshole with DJ software. The heat, the sweat, my anger, Toto, it wells up inside me and I punch my hand through Audrey's window, which is surprisingly easy. Not because I'm strong, but because our house is flimsy. Blood is gushing out of my gangly wrist, so Brooke takes me to the emergency room where they give me stitches. I still have two long scars on my right wrist that people think are suicide attempts until I explain, these are the battle scars of sisterhood. I'll tell you something, people are more interested when they think they're suicide scars. My sister and I get along now, for the most part. We have cry, shout, finger pointy fights every once in a while, and then I have to check into a hotel and we don't speak for a day, but we always make up. We love each other now because we worked our shit out and we're not sharing a bathroom anymore. I hadn't thought about how much we used to beat the shit out of each other. And then last week, I ate a pepper jelly that gave me some sort of allergic reaction and made me feel like I was burning alive from the inside out. It also brightened my scar tissue into glowing red secret messages from the past all over my arms and neck. All of the evidence of our hatred showing up at once. Scratches on my arms from nail fights. Burn marks from attacking each other with curling irons. Bite marks. I thought, if I can survive all this at the hands of my sister, I can certainly take whatever terrible shit awful powerful women are dishing out. Women who are making life more terrible for other women because they haven't gotten the memo that that behavior is retrograde as fuck. In their efforts to play a man's game to get to a position of power, they've aligned themselves against women. I don't think their minds can be changed, so we have to know who they are, be ready for their tactics, and just in case, have our 1.5-inch metal barrel curling iron turned all the way hot. Not all evil hags are easy to spot. Take Phyllis Schlafly. On paper, she's Rosie the Riveter fanfiction. She worked as a ballistic gunner and technician at an ammunition plant during World War II, had a bunch of kids, then became a lawyer in the 70s when only about 4% of lawyers were female. But in practice, she's what I call a bizarro Gloria Steinem. It's as if upon Gloria's birth, the universe sought balance by creating an opposite, a ruthless sort of woman who had become successful in her male